this week, U.S. equities continued the two-week rally with the high-tech NASDAQ index closing at yet a new all-time record high. Welcome back, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, here with you on this July 13th show, episode 652. Well, U.S. equities stole the show this week, ignoring the tariff chatter, focusing instead on slow and steady economic numbers and talks by the U.S. president in Europe. So what does this portend for gold and silver? Joining me with his view on the topic, Arch Crawford, head of Crawford Perspectives, returns with over 40 years experience in these markets. He thinks the gold market is testing key support and could soon stage a rebound rally. Then best-selling author Dr. Stephen Lieb returns with a solid outlook on the gold sector. He thinks the precious metals will merge with the blockchain, improving transactions as well as transparency, and we're already seeing that. Plus, with crude oil setting records in recent months, that could ignite inflation. More good news for the precious metals. And you can call into our Q&A hotline, 641-715-3900, extension number 514049. And Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest report. And you won't want to miss Robert Ian with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a market weather recap. Cloudy skies rolled in over the precious metals sector as investors turned to the improved yield of U.S. dollar relative to competing currencies on expectations of two more rate hikes this year. By Friday's close, gold was off just 15.1%, ending at $12.41 an ounce. Silver was off about 25 cents at $15.81, while the XAU precious metals shares gave back $3.30, ending around $80.50. And after reaching a multi-year high point in recent weeks, black gold did give back about $3, ending at $71, and the Bitcoin ETF also dropped a dollar, about 10%, ending at $9.24. It's near key support, where it really needs to hold this weekend and next week. Otherwise, I may have to call a bear market here on the cryptos, so we'll have to keep a close eye on that. The top story moving the precious metals sector, the U.S. dollar rallied as a safe haven amid the trade war between the two largest global economic superpowers, the U.S. and China. Uncertainty over increasing tariffs and taxes ratcheted up the rate expectations, which can put downward pressure on safe haven asset classes, which carry little or no yield. On Wednesday, the gold market did participate in a global financial market sell-off as the U.S. government reiterated intentions to impose $250 million in tariffs on imported Chinese goods. Tariffs tend to increase costs to the consumer, which can lower overall spending in corporate revenues and profits. And one media report suggested that virtually every item imported from China may be impacted at some level by some of these tariffs, which of course might be detrimental to global trade. On the domestic economic news front, the June Consumer Price Index, released on Wednesday, was up just 0.1%, less than expected, while the June Producer Price Index report was also up about 0.2% from May. The inflation tracking numbers were viewed as innocuous and unlikely to impact Fed officials' plans for another two rate hikes this year. The Fed funds futures currently indicate 85% probability of a rate hike at the upcoming September 26th FOMC meeting and another quarter point rate hike at the last meeting of the year slated for December 19th. Bottom line on precious metals. With the Fed supporting the U.S. dollar, its resilience continues to plague the precious metals, as well as the remarkable U.S. equity strength. Investors just can't get enough of U.S. shares. So for the time being, our anticipated breakout from the inverted head and shoulders pattern is still on hold. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited yet again over the New York Stock Exchange as investors turned once again to U.S. shares on tame U.S. economic numbers. By Friday's close, the Dow Jones added to last week's gains, up an impressive 562 points at 25,019, still above the psychological resistance level of 25,000. The S&P picked up 42, 1.5%, ending at 2760, while the NASDAQ climbed the most to a new all-time record, adding 137 points, about 2%, at 7825. Listeners will recall that right around 5,000 was where the year 2000 peak came to pass for the Nasdaq. So we're up almost 3,000 points above that level currently. And as our friend Ralph Acampora is fond of saying, these are nosebleed levels. The top story impacting U.S. equities, investors applauded efforts by the president in Brussels to convince NATO allies to boost their defense spending to 2% of national GDP by 2024. The president further claimed that the NATO allies have committed to this military spending and may reach the numbers sooner than expected. Intriguing shares in the news and topping Zacks rating list, CPI, Aerostructures, ticker CVU. I like this company. Involving contract production of structural aircraft parts and commercial and military aircraft parts, which ties in well with the increased military spending around the globe. Zacks expects the earnings to grow by 32%, and it's a number one strong buy. The technical outlook on my chart looks appealing here as well. And Kratos Defense and Security Solutions, ticker KTOS, also has an incredibly strong chart. It's involved in national security technology, two key areas of the future, security and technology, providing key solutions for the United States National Security Priorities Team. U.S. shares, bottom line. The USA Today 7 Indicator Greed to Fear Index pendulum remains in the neutral category. That's a big plus given the market strength, which indicates that the herd has maybe not yet picked up on the theme. They're still nervous while the pros are buying up shares. Clearly, investors' appetite for this pro-U.S. business attitude of our president is a plus, and they're unperturbed by potential trade tariffs, as long as they do not escalate out of control. For the time being, it looks like more blue skies ahead. We'd like for you to stay with us here. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Stephen Leib, former editor of Personal Finance and one of the most widely read financial newsletters, over 100,000 subscribers, author of many books. Welcome back, Dr. Leib.
Chris, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, especially given the, like so many of our guests lately, you're recovering from some ailments that just not fun. Before the talk, you were mentioning your concern about many issues of the economy and I guess the markets in general.
What should I say? It's interesting times, as the Chinese would say. The Chinese, I think, are very much front and center in terms of what's happening. I have to say, Chris, though I still hope for a kind of win-win situation in these circumstances, I think it's getting harder to do that. I have a feeling that we're not playing a winning hand. And I really haven't had that kind of a strong feeling about it. I'm not, saying that we're definitely going to lose or we're definitely going to end up in a second-rate situation, but I will say this, that I think we're our own worst enemies. This is not a political statement by any stretch of the imagination. It's really the dancer in the dance. There's a certain dance America has to do. We've gotten to a certain spot where we have to sort of address certain issues. And I just don't think we're going about it the right way. I think China is doing things in very much the right way. I'm not sure if we understand and to what extent we understand really how far China has advanced and how far they've progressed and sort of their entire mindset. It's very cynical. They present themselves in ways that are very misleading, in fact, totally misleading. And I don't think we have a sense of that. And I think that President Trump is right when he says that it's been, an unfair playing field. But to correct that, I don't think that you really want to follow a course that he's following right now, tariffs, etc. I think that this should be a Sputnik moment for us. And we're being deprived of that. And then we're being deprived of that, I think, by the Chinese. In the wake of Sputnik, America rolled up its sleeves, really advanced education, science, what they now call STEM. We were full throttle in terms of catching up to the Soviet Union. We really weren't that far behind, if behind at all. But we really took it to another level. We turbocharged our education. We turbocharged our focus on science, et cetera. And, soon thereafter, within a little more than a decade, I think, or maybe it was less than a decade, we sent a man to the moon. We haven't been back there since, but we did manage to do that. This time around, I think we're faced with a much more difficult situation vis-a-vis China. I think that they, fortunately, they are not like the Soviet Union in many ways. And unfortunately, they're not like the Soviet Union in many ways. The unfortunate is that they are very organized, and they are kind of like, one of the most intelligent comments I've heard about China was this fellow Martin Schock. He wrote a book whose title he regretted. It was called When China Rules the World. He did not want to imply that. But one of the ways he described China was a civilization state, as distinct from a nation state, a city state, etc. They're a civilization in which sort of everyone knows their role in the civilization, and they function like that, and they've been doing it for about 4,000 or 5,000 years. And this gives them certain advantages. You know, there's certain disadvantages, obviously. I don't want to, you know, live with their lack of freedom and etc. But, you know, there are advantages in terms of education, in terms of how fast and how far they can go how fast in a limited period of time, meaning. And it's remarkable what they've done, and it's also remarkable how well they've disguised how far they've gone. And, you know, our response, I just don't think is right. I think it's hurting us much more than it's hurting them. I think the wrap-up is, and sort of what my book is about, is that, you know, we will have a new monetary system. It will not be based on the yuan. The Chinese do not want that. They really, you know, are against any sovereign currency being the basis for a monetary system, because it leads to overvaluation in that currency, etc. But it will be a monetary system in which the yuan will play a role, and the dollar, hopefully, will play a role, and gold will be, I think, the center of that system. That's, the Chinese have said that, you know, in so many words. They, you know, you can actually find quotes that if you translate them from Chinese to English, you find that that's exactly what they're saying, that gold should be the heart of the Chinese dream, et cetera, et cetera. The fortunate thing about this is that the Chinese, I don't believe, are after worldwide hegemony. They are after self-fulfilling life for their people, for their citizens. And they do feel that involves an active world economy. And everybody's welcome to play. And, you know, if we can sort of accept that and be part of this, I think that it could be, you know, a fairly good life. I don't think we have to give up anything that we treasure in this country.
Imagine how betrayed you would feel. You've spent, 30, 40 years adopting Western business practices, building up infrastructure, mimicking us, learning from us, eclipsing much of our success, and allowing businesses, multinationals to come from the West, breaking the giant wall of China down. Let's let in the multinationals and encouraging cooperation and all kinds of synergies. The Western culture says, well, we can't compete with you anymore. We're going to, throw up $250 billion in trade barriers with our largest trading partner and the second largest economy in the world.
Look, it doesn't make sense. I mean, on two levels. I mean, I can understand the Western point of view being upset by this. And all of a sudden, you know, fearing that they're trying to, you know, take our spot in the world. But if we're really upset about this, answer like we did when, you know, we saw that Russian satellite over our heads, literally. I mean, you know, I'm old enough to kind of remember that.
Let's be proactive instead of reactive. We could have shot down Sputnik, but I'm sure there would have been a way to remove Sputnik from orbit. But instead, we put someone on the moon and then several other Apollo missions, I believe, subsequently. Let's learn from their success and create our, instead of creating punitive situations that hurt everyone in a trade war.
Basically, I mean, maybe they're high-performing Aspergers. I mean, they could have been. But if they had been taken aside, and they do this in China, Chris, and they do it in Israel, and what they do with these kids is they put them all together, and they really try and, you know, create I mean, it sounds like 1980 or what, Brave New World, but it's not really. They try and provide them an environment in which, I mean, if you're really gifted and you know more than the teacher and you're in, and, you know, I could tell you horror stories about, you know, kids like this and ended up in a computer, behind a computer for about a year and a half. I mean, literally, and, you know, could have made major computer contributions to our society, and we weren't like this. I mean, we've become so obsessed with, you know, treating everybody in a politically correct way, we sort of forget that the people that are really good with numbers and words, all right? And they're not necessarily our brightest, they're just different. They're not really good with people. There, which I think is probably much more difficult to be, but they're very, very good with numbers and words, and we just cast them aside. I've just seen this happen too many times, and I'm just saying that this is one reason why I think we're trailing the Chinese and even the Russians in certain areas. It's one reason why, you know, I hate to say this, but I mean, when it comes to things like computers, I mean, the Chinese may have passed us. They really may have. And I can give you a couple of stories if you want. And this is from the news media. This is not, you know, this is not stuff that I heard in an internet chat room where someone told someone else something. This is stuff from Reuters. This is stuff from, you know, credible sites where, you know, the evidence is the Chinese are really doing very, very special things. I think that there was a time when kids that, you know, were really good with numbers and words, I don't want to say gifted. I mean, I think truly gifted people are people that get along with other people. President Reagan was a totally gifted person. He was a person that, you know, he just had to say was gifted. He communicated well. President Clinton, with all his foibles, was gifted. I mean, he's super smart, but he was also able to communicate and get along with people, Martin Luther King. This type of giftedness that I'm talking about is the type that is sort of, you know, sort of cast aside. There is not really that much of an emotional component to it. It's just really being good in math or music or languages, etc. And this is the kind of kid that is, you know, really cast aside and ends up paying a huge price. And if they get through, they tend to, you know, really do move the needle in ways that we need to move it. I just see too much of it not happening. It did happen after Sputnik. I mean, we used to have something, I'm sure you know about this, but I mean, we used to have something called Bell Labs in this country. And it ran fine. It was basically a private-public partnership between, you know, AT&T and the government, universities, MIT was involved. And, you know, out of this, there were a bunch of really weird people. People like Shannon, Shockley, I mean, who knows, Bardeen. I mean, a number of strange folks that came together. They created the transistor, the laser, the internet. I mean, all the bases of modern technology came out of this one laboratory, which was a public-private consortium, produced all this. We don't have that anymore. I mean, what's our new Bell Labs? I don't see it anywhere.
That's what we hope to be doing right here on a much, of course, more humble level and basic level. But look at the last four guests on the show. Okay, you have Robert Kiyosaki, self-made individual, Peter Grandich, and then of Ralph Acampora. Diverse minds, all key in their areas. How can you compare Dr. Shockley, who brought together, what was it, the dissenting eight, I think it was, with, you know, Dr. Noyce at the head, and they came together and created Fairchild Semiconductor, the follow-up. Intel, of course, they put us on the moon, as we've maybe mentioned in the past. They're semiconductors.
Exactly right. They were given a chance to really, really shine. And right now, I mean, you know, I don't want to get into sort of the politics of it, but it's so much political correctness. I mean, and if you're thought of as different, I mean, everybody is given a break if they're different, except for people that are good at numbers and words.
But you have Noyce, who was interesting individually, grew up on a farm, absolutely no mentoring or what, tinkering with anything from a, you might say, farm equipment to radios. He just had a magnetic personality, very rare, as you say, to inspire confidence in others. They didn't have this invisible hand that you seem to be saying is important to accomplishing a RAND-like institute for exceptional talent.
I think that basically we should try and reconstitute Bell Labs. I mean, I think that we need more public-private institutions. I mean, AT&T basically was a monopoly provider of telecommunications in this country, and they were regulated like a utility. And they were allowed to have this subsidiary, which they called Bell Labs. And they were able to, I guess maybe this is it, Chris, for a second. It really is having this institution where people can do their research, do their thing. There is no real pressure to publish. There is no pressure to do anything but, you know, be creative.
Let's look at Srinivasa Ramanujan. Here is an interesting case. Everyone knows the story, so we won't bug people about the math whiz from India, the Brahmin.
Look at Girdle. They brought him. These were not normal folks. They didn't go out to parties.
You remember what Einstein said? He said, I came to Princeton because Goodell is here.
They were comfortable talking among one another. That's how we got, you know, so much, you know, among them. Well, how about Turing? T-U-R-I-N-G. I mean, he was there at Princeton. He studied under von Neumann.
Talk about a savant. He could factor numbers, they say, up to 7 or 8 digits instantaneously.
Extraordinary. But think about Turing. I mean, you know, for basically helping Britain win the war, there's no doubt that he did. I mean, he cracked the code. He was strange. But, I mean, while he was at Princeton, he never should have gone back to England, probably. He went back to England because of the war. And, you know, he really contributed a lot. But I think if he had stayed in America, he would have probably found a permanent. In fact, he was offered a job by von Neumann.
But also take a look at Flowers and Tutte, who were actually follow-ups with Turing, working side-by-side with Turing at, I think it was King's College, and they moved to Canada and had careers, and only at the end of their life were they allowed to discuss the fact that they cracked the code above Enigma. Look up Flowers and Tutte. You'll find their story fascinating.
Well, absolutely will. Yes, that is interesting. That's extremely interesting. Yeah, I mean, this is what we need. This is what Israel has. And Chris, they do the same thing in China. I mean, and it doesn't matter what your skill set is. I mean, just to give you one example, they recently played, because I like chess and I study it with, you know, this Russian guy once a week, but whatever. And so I follow it. But and I don't want to, you know, make myself sound like I'm a great chess player. I'm certainly not. But I do understand the game fairly well. Recent world championship for women in chess was between the second best and the third best player in China. I mean, the first best didn't even compete, but they were both Chinese women. Now, you know, you see this push for feminism in this country, et cetera. China has no such push. What they do, though, is if they find someone that is really special in whatever skill sets they may have, they will put them together. And they will, you know, foster, you know, the betterment of these skill sets. And, you know, chess is one of the things that they focused on. And, you know, among the top 50 or 60 chess players, and I'm talking males, in the world, the most and the youngest in that group happen to be Chinese. And this is from nowhere. 20 years ago, I don't think they even had a grandmaster in China. And it's just remarkable. And when you look at computers, and I was coming back to this, with these tariffs and everything else, there was a news item. If I can, you know, I'm sort of, it's really not a non sequitur because we're talking exactly about, you know, this kind of thing. And I had it here on my screen, but I don't have it right now. But I could tell you, I picked it up accidentally because I'm one of these people that stay up late at night and I look at the news, etc. And it came across, it came across Reuters. And it was reported, Reuters was reporting a comment from the research director at Symantec, which is a cybersecurity firm. I think it's probably one of the largest in the country, though they've had a few problems lately. And what they said, and it just floored me, they said that there has been an attack on our satellites. And it wasn't just getting data from our satellites. It was actually taking control of our satellites. I mean, it's a little bit scary. And basically, it meant that the attackers, the hackers, actually did have control of our satellites for a certain period of time. And then they gave it up. they traced these attacks, and this is almost equally interesting, they traced them to three computers in China. Now, lately, we haven't read about any Chinese attacks. We've read about North Korean attacks, and if you really believe that, you know, North Korea could penetrate the SWIFT payment system or penetrate Sony with no real computers there, you know, I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. I don't believe that those attacks came from North Korea. I believe that they probably came from China, and the point being, China can disguise what they're doing. I mean, any good hacker can disguise where those attacks came, where an attack came from. Here, there was no attempt to disguise that these attacks were coming from China. And basically, what the Chinese were saying to us is, be careful. You know, if you want to go as far as you need to go without really doing anything to upset the world economy, because this is what we can do. They can take control of a satellite. This is my interpretation, but what actually happened is not my interpretation. Again, this came from Symantec, that they had control of these satellites, etc. And if you think about what this means, having control of one of our satellites, it means that we could launch a drone. I'm being sort of facetious here, but who knows, that we could launch a drone, and that drone may make a U-turn and come back and land in one of our cities. Who knows? I mean, you know, this is what we rely on. This is our GPS systems, et cetera. These military they were military satellites. I don't know whether I said that. And basically, that is pretty frightening. And, you know, how does that happen? How in the world does it happen that they can take control of such vital instrumentation, military instrumentation?
You recall the Stuxnet fiasco. Obviously, we had Tel Aviv and Washington work together and destroy those uranium refinement centrifugal force units. Because you'll recall the worm essentially said, well, we're only going to spin it really fast when no one's in the room. They melted down the units, and they were able to mask it so that it was very difficult to trace it back.
They wanted us to know what they could do if they wanted to. Now, I'll give you another piece of news, and this one I really researched, all right? And again, you know, look, I'm just reporting the news. I'm just, Chris, here I am just a reporter. I don't have any great knowledge of physics or what goes into anything. But I was really impressed and sort of, I was willing to say, wow, we've really made, we're more advanced than I thought in certain areas. When ZTE, the Chinese telecommunications company, they said that if they could not buy certain parts from the U.S., they would have to go out of business. I mean, I think everyone knows that story. 70,000 ZTE employees were ready to go on the bread, and they would never have gone on the bread line because they're too talented and there's too many other places for them to go. But ZTE would have to shut down. Explain, ZTE was a prominent so-called state-of-the-art smartphones in China, and was considered a central company to their efforts to take the Internet to the next level, 5G. They're competing with us. And all of a sudden, we sanctioned them. They did something wrong. There's no doubt that they did something wrong, and there's no doubt that sanctions were appropriate. What they said is that without their ability, I mean, the sanctions said that they could no longer buy any parts from the United States. No more of these transistors, optical transistors, whatever. And as a result of being barred from buying U.S. goods, they said that they could no longer function and that they had to go out of business. And then, you know, there was a big to-do, and I think Trump now is saying that, you know, we don't want them going out of business. We want to, you know, just, you know, guard them, et cetera, be careful. But whatever. So it appeared in the press that China basically did not have the technologies that they claimed to have. Now, it made such an impression in the media in this country that the New York Times, based on this, started a weekly article saying, why has China fallen behind? This was sort of the guts of the article, the weekly column. Why China fell behind the U.S. in terms of these technologies. Okay, so I was really impressed. So I'm starting to look at the products that ZTE was importing from the U.S. And, you know, make a long story short, all these products they could have gotten from other companies, other countries, either from Taiwan, and many of them they could have gotten from China itself. They were making these products. One of them, the most important company there in terms of technology, is a private company, and I'm going to totally butcher the pronunciation, but it's Huawei, H-U-A-W-E-I, I think. And they are making a lot of these parts that, and they're competitors of ZTE, but they were also making a lot of the parts that ZTE was importing from the United States. So, I mean, if the Chinese, the way they run things, they could have just said to Huawei or maybe other companies, okay, you give ZTE these parts. We don't want them, but they didn't do that. They let us think that ZTE was forced to go out of business. So, I mean, and this is all, I mean, everything here is valid. I'm just, again, a reporter. So what I did is I started looking at Huawei also makes smartphones. And I started looking at their latest smartphone. And I looked at some of the specs on it. Make a long story short, again, I'm saying that. ZTE's latest phone, I believe it's called the Mate 20. And I don't think we are even allowed to buy it in this country. For whatever reason, I have no idea. But anyway, the Mate 20 has been put through certain tests, and it's on a test site. I mean, you can verify it. I think it's called ANTUTU, and it's considered, I think, you know, the way of measuring how powerful or how fast these smartphones are. The latest Huawei smartphone is about 70% faster than the iPhone X, our greatest iPhone, our greatest smartphone, much faster, uses a sort of neural processing system, which makes it very adaptable to artificial intelligence. And I'm saying, oh my gosh, we've just been taken to the cleaners. I mean, here's the New York Times writing articles, gainsaying Chinese technology, and here's us buying this hook, line, and sinker. And in the meantime, borrowing a phone that, you know, the Chinese don't have any problem with us buying their phone and trying to reverse engineer what they've done. But, you know, we won't even do it. I mean, something is lost here. I mean, we've become so scared and so insular, so fearful of trading and doing things that we're losing the forest from the trees.
It's innovation. And I think that's really the heart of your message today. The central importance of innovation to remaining competitive, not only as a nation, but as individuals, as a society. And you know, the funny thing about innovation, if we look at all the examples that come to mind, the Wozniak, Bill Gates, and all the rest of the early ones, I guess we have to fast forward to more modern times, Facebook, Google, and others. It's wasteful. The initial stages of startups.
Right. And China gives them all the freedom in the world, despite the fact that it's a so-called authoritarian society. If you want to develop this, you're free. Here's the money. Go for it. And that's why they're attracting Western scientists there, Chris. They really are. I mean, you know, read this thing about these gifted guys, particular areas. I mean, there's a place for them, too. And, you know, we can accommodate every sort of person in this country, and we've made we've made ourselves great by doing it. But all of a sudden, unless you're impaired, and look, I'm all for it, and I hate saying things like this. I think if people are impaired, they should be helped. Yes, we're a great country, but if you're impaired socially, taking it to such an extreme because of political correctness, look, there is a, you know, there appeared a tweet. I don't really participate in Twitter, but someone sent me a copy of a tweet that somebody else sent. Law school admission tests. Okay, someone is applying to law school, and they have a section where you have to check gender. Now, you know, look, I'm egalitarian. I'm completely, I really am, and I respect. But here is what I mean by taking something to an extreme. We used to regard we've sort of gone so far in the direction of giving everybody, their unique rights that no one has any rights at all. Everybody is just a number. You're just a number. And you just can't run a country like that. I mean, you just can't. Like my friend said that the BS meter has blown all the fuses. And, you know, we're paying a price for this. I mean,
this is really a topic probably for a different show today. But I mean, you've made some very valid points that I know will resonate.
Leaving people with one, the world is headed toward a new kind of monetary system. I think that China is in a position to really dictate what that system is going to be because of their control of the developing world. And Chris, just give you one first. This is as in 2012 or 2011 or 2012, for the first time in history, the developing world became larger than the high income world. Everything below high income, I call developing. Up until 2012, there had never been a time when the high income world was actually smaller than the developing world. That happened in 2012. It happened courtesy of China, not only because of China's great strength, but because China basically has been a coalescer with the Belt Road Initiative, all the BRIC initiative, the SCO, all these other initiatives have brought the developing world as sort of a I won't say single mass, but they're growing together. Sri Lanka. I mean, you hear negative stories about what China did in Sri Lanka. Well, whatever they did, Sri Lanka right now has lower trade deficits, they have lower government deficits, and their GDP is growing at 5%. Ditto for Pakistan. So what you have are all these countries moving together. This is going to be extraordinarily bullish for commodities. It's going to require a new monetary system. And the message, coming down to it as quickly as I can, and sort of the message of my book coming, if I ever finish it, is, I do have a contract, is gold is going to be the center of a new monetary system. It won't be the yuan. It'll appear to be the yuan at first because that's how you're going to segue into gold. But the Chinese do not want the yuan as the center of a monetary system. They want gold. They want a basket of currencies, maybe something to do with commodities. And the dollar can play, and we can play, and we can all live in a happy worldwide situation. Or we can, choose to sabotage it. Basically, America is in a position where they could establish themselves as they want, same political system, everything else, freedoms, etc. Part of, I think, a very dynamic world economy that'll have to ration, certain commodities, etc. But we'll be there. We will have a chance to do it. Our technologies can develop, etc. One of the most critical times, I think, maybe the most critical time in the history of humankind. We're living through it, but it's going to be very, very interesting times ahead of us, Chris.
You talk about gold being the center of the financial monetary system. What I'd like to hear is whether or not you believe that digital gold might also play an important role.
Blockchain will play a very, very critical role. Because it is a good technology, and the Chinese are on top of it. Not only do they have cheap energy, which is one thing that you need. I mean, calculating how much energy we use, that is almost impossible to do. But however much we use, China has probably, because of their hydro, they have the largest sources of cheap energy. So yes, blockchain will be a very, very important part of it. But, digital gold, I'm not sure what you mean by that. You will have a fixed supply of gold, and that fixed supply will have to move up in value, and move up dramatically, because it will have to back, all our trade in a way. Yes, it will have to back it. And that might imply, the value of physical gold being, huge numbers. But that physical gold will exist in a digital sphere. You will have blockchains that encompass gold, but it won't be some sort of figment. I don't think you'll have gold as a figment. I think it will be real gold as a backing, but that real gold will be represented digitally in what is used for trade. He's the one that got me started on all this stuff about the how we so mistreat, people that are good with numbers and words. In Russia, he was in St. Petersburg, and he would be interested in this. In St. Petersburg, they have these special schools, where they put very bright young people. And they don't care what they're like. I have to thank you because this conversation took my mind off you know, the things that are troubling, you know, the pain and everything. So this is great. I really appreciate it.
I've never been told that this was an analgesic show. A lot of our listeners would like to hear your thoughts on light sweet crude. And this has been an interesting story. I mean, obviously OPEC agreed to curtail output by more than expected to 600,000 barrels per day. This sent oil in part, and plus there's other issues, geopolitical issues on the table, but that helped in part send the oil soaring to levels we haven't seen in quite some time. I'd like to know if A, you see this as a potential inflation indicator, and B, whether or not you think this is also a positive for the yellow metal and silver.
It's definitely a positive for gold and silver. There's no doubt that higher oil prices are, you know, inflationary. They imply scarce commodities, and just those two factors are extremely positive for gold, extremely. And also positive for gold is how hard it is to get oil down in value. I mean, I think the Saudis will probably be at maximum production, and I think excess capacity in the world is very, very limited, probably less than it may have ever been. I mean, it's a very frightening kind of situation. I'm personally looking at it right now and hope oil does come down a little bit. But, you know, what is so often overlooked here is how much oil and energy, and in particular oil, does it take to frack. Fracking has been, you know, made the marginal source of oil in this world does not come from OPEC or any other particular country like Russia. The marginal source for the time being is coming from basically the Permian Basin in this country, which right now is locked in because we don't have enough pipeline now to you know, route it out. And if you think about these factors that are, you know, enclosing oil, what you have to think, what will it take to get the oil to flow from the Permian? Well, it's going to take a tremendous amount of energy. Oil itself, I mean, you're going to have to build pipelines, drilling these wells as well as they do. And, yeah, technology has done something. But basically what they've figured out is how do we use more water, more sand to get more oil. But the point is using more sand, more water is also using a lot more energy. It is not a really great way of solving our energy problem, to say the least. We do have a very severe problem regarding oil and our dependency on oil. And I think that this is illustrating it right now. That, you know, here you have OPEC and Saudi Arabia saying they're going to pump more oil than they ever have. And you have a world right now that's willing to say, bring it on. In the case of China, we'll stockpile it. China's stockpiling, you know, any critical commodity that you can name, Chris, China is stockpiling the daylights out of it because they realize going down the road, there's not going to be that much of this commodity left. And oil is certainly in that category. So basically, I think we're kind of shooting ourselves in the foot. And yes, coming back to what you asked me, I think it's extremely bullish for gold, longer term. Just exceptionally bullish for gold. It illustrates the need for gold and silver and especially gold. So yes, it is exceptionally bullish for gold.
Well, I guess as we wrap up, then the only key question left is when will Dr. Lieb's next tome finally be released?
Well, I have a September deadline from McGraw-Hill, which I'm not going to make, but I would say certainly by the end of the year I will have the book finished, and then it's going to be up to McGraw-Hill, and hopefully it'll come out in time for a bull market, just as the next huge leg in the bull market in gold starts. But I've had very bad luck timing. Just very briefly, when I wrote Define the Market, which was about the fall in technology in the beginning of this century, that was 6 months early. That came out in mid-1999. The difference between having a book that sold okay and having a bestseller was 6 months. Publishing is not something you want to get into. It's not a good way of making a living, especially if you're trying to predict things. I mean, you know, be wrong by 5 or 6 months, but be generally very, very right, and you have a bust. But if you catch it exactly right, probably you're going to be wrong in the long term, But you're going to have a very successful book, so, you know, take it from there. But hopefully sometime in 2019, I think it feels like that could be the time when you really see gold explode. It feels like that. But again, don't take that to the bank.
It certainly looks like it in, you know, the technical position. We have been winding up in a narrow trading range, slightly upward bias. That tends to lead to explosive moves, and they love to catch investors off guard.
One data point I want to get you right, and one data point that I want to get sort of bring home is that gold right now is almost completely linked to the yuan. It's really, you know, it's down, but it's not so much down because the dollar is strong. It's down because the yuan is weak. What China has done with allowing oil to trade in yuan and yuan exchangeable for gold, they've created a system in which, you know, you can really arbitrage. And so if you look at the 52-week moving average or the 200-day moving average of yuan, of gold priced in yuan, almost no variation. Almost none. So what the Chinese have created is a situation in which the yuan is as good as gold. Now, the downside of that is you're seeing lately when the yuan gets weak, gold will get weak. But once the yuan gets stronger again, gold will get strong. So really that's kind of a clue, I think, that, and it's, again, it's verifiable. You just, you have a Bloomberg terminal, it's really easy, but if you don't, just look at XAU or the price of gold in yuan. And you'll see, take a 52-week moving average or a 200-day moving average, and you'll see that they're very straight.
Really like to see it on the 50-day. The 200 is neat because it is the 50-day for the weekly chart.
Best of luck over the next few weeks, and I hope you come here. Bye-bye, Chris.
It's a pleasure to welcome back Arch Crawford at the helm of Crawford Perspectives now, since I think the Dow Jones first came into inception. Is that right, Arch?
Pretty close. Started watching the market in December of 54. I was 13.
You know, before the show, we were talking about the surprising rise in crude oil and how that tends to sometimes precede the precious metals and some of the other commodities higher. And you also have some bearish thoughts on U.S. equities.
Yes. Well, that has been going on a while. We went short in January, and we predicted the top day within a day in the January letter, which, of course, the top was Jan 26, and we were saying it looked like it might, something like that might happen around the 25th. Stayed somewhat bearish, and, of course, we're getting there rather rapidly again here with the Dow down 8 days in a row. And it was down, I think, 3.9% or something like that. It was a pretty good drop for 8 days. But the other major indices did not confirm in that same record-setting way. But what does confirm is that the foreign markets are off. I think one other market letter writer says his index of the foreign markets was off 6.9 on the year to date. Of course, my favorite is Shanghai, which from intraday high to Friday's low was off over 21%.
You might agree some of the fundamentals driving, maybe pushing these markets underwater a bit. Talk of an additional $200 billion in sanctions or tariffs against our largest trading partner, China. Of course, the second largest economy in the world. That's on top of $50 billion with our nearby neighbors, Mexico, Canada. They're also expanding that to include automobile sanctions on Europe. Or the EU ministers are threatening sanctions against the United States.
I've got the moon on the midheaven in Capricorn, and Capricorn is politics. I think I have a very good handle on politics, ahead of most people without the real information on the inside. Of course, they've got it. They may have it nailed, but even the insiders occasionally get hit by a surprise or someone with an opposing opinion.
Did you run across that article last week that claimed Washington, D.C. had the highest per capita rate of psychopaths?
Specifically on the gold chart on the weekly on the back of the letter shows that it came right back down to a light line. It was the bottom line of a rising channel, and there was a light one, and then there's a heavier one. Well, it broke the light one on Friday and went down a little further. It went down to the heavy support line. So it's still holding. It has the potential of either bouncing from here or gapping down in a more major way.
Do you feel that the rally we'd seen earlier in the year and the end of last year has come to an end?
As long as the lower channel line holds, yes, it will go higher. But I'm concerned about it. And a little bit lower is the 200-week moving average. It's down about 1241 or two. So that's really like the last hope. If that holds, it could still go up, but I would prefer that the lighter line had held, and I strongly prefer that the heavy line, slightly lower line that is parallel to it, I want to see that hold.
Silver and the XAU held up relatively well last week at closing near break even. While the yellow metal sold off, gold is obviously sensitive to the volatility in the U.S. dollar strength there. And we've seen that strength on several fronts. Firstly, the tariffs, at least on paper, might temporarily, at least early on, benefit the U.S. That's the thinking by some analysts. And then we've had a hawkish Fed, which just last week continued to indicate we'll probably see at least one more, maybe two more rate hikes this year. Higher rates tend to bode well for the greenback and less so for our metals, which don't offer a yield in some of their forms, in the physical form. Anything in the constellations that might suggest we could see one of those emergency moments?
Well, we have two terrible eclipses this month, in July. And the real big thing that's scary, the first one is lunar eclipse, and it's conjunct Pluto in both latitude and declination. We had a good one in 1986 in April, a lunar eclipse conjunct Pluto, and 4 days later Chernobyl melted down. So it's comparable to that. That one raised the radiation levels around the whole world. And then the next one, the 27th, I think, I forget which is conjunct and which is opposite. On the 12th, we have the solar eclipse, 20 degrees Cancer, 10:47 p.m. Eastern Daylight, opposes Pluto. So the one on the 27th will be conjunct, the solar eclipse conjunct Mars. So this one is a lunar eclipse on the 27th, but the Mars closest and brightest since 2003 on the day of the lunar eclipse.
That sounds ominous.
The last time we had that kind of event, or the kind of event where there was a lunar eclipse and Mars was opposite Pluto at the same time, and they formed a grand cross, a great cross, grand cross. Sun opposite Moon, Mars opposite Pluto, and they were all at 90-degree angles to each other, predicted. I said there will be coercion, the use of force, a large explosion, and heartlessness or cruelty August the 2nd to the 7th, 1990. And Barron's thought that was such a cute prediction that they printed it in their stock market section, of quotes from different letters. Saddam Hussein unexpectedly attacked Kuwait. I got two phone calls from the United States and three from Europe, and nothing ever said about it at all after that.
You say from the United States, was that from the State Department or the Pentagon?
These were people who read about it in Barron's and just were interested.
I bet. I mean, they want to know, hey, what does Arch know that we need to know?
Yeah, well, on the other one, when I predicted 9/11, the FBI called me from Phoenix.
Were you then living in Arizona at the time, or were you still in New York?
Yeah, I was here from 96. There's a stock market guy who's done a lot of work for some of the hedge funds. It's a known name, and I can't think of it right this minute. He told him to call me. He said, well, you ought to see what this guy Crawford said. He predicted the U.S. will be at war around the 7th or 8th.
So you actually might be picking up on some of this backpedaling following the, let's call it air quotes, successful summit between North Korea and the United States and Singapore. I was thinking in terms of your ominous sign that's coming up and the potential for new warfare.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't know if it'll be us. That eclipse last year.
Back to the markets. Anything else you see that investors should be watching for? What about U.S. equities? Do you think that we're nearing the ultimate nadir? If you look at the charts, I know you're a technician. If you exclude the constellations and those calculations for a minute, from a purely technical perspective, a long consolidation at these levels might imply a Dow 40, 50,000 or higher.
Well, that's if the dollar goes, the value is going to go up that much.
The value hinges on a currency crisis, and just as we saw in Weimar and other places recently in Venezuela, with $35 billion bolivar per ounce of gold when it was one-to-one parity with the U.S. dollar just last year. These things can unfold quickly. Most of my guests seem to think that we'd never see anything like that here. What do you think?
I agree. Every crash has occurred during the same part of the Mars-Uranus cycle, the same 40%. I wrote an article about it when there had been like seven of them, and now there have been 10 of them. And so all the projections have been accurate. But the thing is, it's a two-year cycle, so it doesn't, there are a lot of times when it doesn't crash. It's hard to say which one it will be. But I've managed to call them in time to catch the major movement, and sometimes the top to the day.
I see what looks like an almost end of days, or more like a 1939-1940 Warsaw scenario unfolding here in the United States. Incidentally, so does Dr. Paul Craig Roberts.
Well, I studied the numbers that were coming out from the New York Stock Exchange from 7% to 80%, 5%. They never mentioned after that what the planetary aspects, 26 to 30, are negative. The worst are July 26th to 30th, July 1st, 12th to 16th, 20th, 25th to 27th. And August 1st and 2nd. So I don't think we're going to go screaming back up again anytime soon.
If you were building a portfolio right now, you wouldn't even think about it right now. But let's just say you had to. Where would you be overweight and where would you be underweighting?
I would be overweight shorts. And if I had to buy longs, well, there's all these things you can buy long now that are short positions in all kinds of ETFs now. But a hedge fund probably would not like you to put that much into shorts anymore after the last few years. They were big on shorting before, and I think they will be again.
So you think then that it's time to, if you've had some good luck in stocks, to maybe hedge yourself or even lighten up? Do you see bonds as an alternative?
Yeah, but I think you better buy highest rated bonds.
What do you think of the ETF, the U.S. dollar ticker UUP?
This is DX on my system, and it's now bouncing around 94. Yeah, okay, the dollar index is in my newsletter, and I'm looking for a pullback from like 94 to 95 down to 91, and if it does that, it'll be a perfect. And then heads back up, it'll be a reverse head and shoulder bottom.
Okay.
But I'm 100% short in the newsletter without using full margin. Been since the middle of January.
Arch Crawford, always a pleasure. Thank you. You want to tell people more, please, about Crawford Perspective?
41st year, 2 days from this recording. We have some of the best records in the business, being number one market timer for several different periods since we've been publishing. And to reach it, it's CrawfordPerspectives@earthlink.net, or just Google Arch Crawford. That'll be the first or second one to come up as the website. And you can sign up on the website, or you can call the office. We like you to send a check. And that's Crawford Perspective. That's the email. And the phone number is 520-577-1158.
All right, Arch, we appreciate your thoughts.
Thank you very much.
This is Robert Ian with GouldSeek.com Radio. An article circulating from the Washington Post explains how more people are working well past the generally thought of retirement age of 65. Quite a ways past, in fact. 255,000 Americans age 85 and over were working during the last 12 months. That equates to 4.4% of the American population that age, which is up from 2.6% in 2006, just before the onset of the 2008 financial collapse. It's reported as the highest number on record. What kinds of jobs does someone who is 85 do? All kinds. Crossing guards, farmers, ranchers, and truck drivers. In fact, there is somewhere approaching 3,000 U.S. truck drivers age 85 or older, according to the 2016 Census Bureau figures. One of the biggest challenges noted by this article is that baby boomers and their parents are working longer as life expectancies grow. Contributing to this are shrinking retirement plans, higher education levels, and work that is less physically demanding. Labor Department figures show that at every year of age above 55, U.S. residents are either working or looking for work at the highest rates on record. There's no doubt financial circumstances are a key driver in this changing workforce demographic. However, other factors will definitely play a role. Staying focused and engaged on some kind of activity is a critical element for long-term survival and happiness. My mentor told me when I was a young man that he had retired once for about 6 months and then went back to work for the fun and sport of it. The other night I had a fascinating conversation with a gentleman I met while each of us were out walking our dogs. He said he didn't retire in the traditional sense of the word. He simply rewired the way he thought about what he wants to do when he gets up each morning. There's a wide spectrum of reasons people will continue to work or stay engaged longer and longer as they move beyond what is considered the traditional age of retirement. It's a question or process many will still block out or avoid addressing, thinking it will somehow take care of itself. Actually, it's a topic that should never go off your radar map, but instead should be revisited and reworked based on your situation on some kind of regular interval. Because time, your time, cannot be saved or invested. It can only be spent. So, what's on your shopping list? And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. Thanks, Chris.
Okay, Robert, thanks for another excellent installment. Well, that wraps up this week's GoldSeek.com radio episode. For two new big guests, be sure to check out next week's show. Until we talk to you again, have a great week.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.